As I said to those of you who were here last night, I had no idea when we booked the Rougier Hotel and when we made the decision to use this as our principal meeting room that our friend here would be overlighting us. This is Count Willem Rosenberg, who was the person who really brought Český Krumlov to its apex in the late 16th century. He was himself a student of the esoteric arts and an alchemist. Tonight, he did a lot. He built that tower out there, the extension to the castle. And tonight, we will actually be in a Renaissance hall next to his private chambers. He was followed by his brother, Peter Vok Rosenberg, around 1600. And he was the one, in fact, who protected John Dee during the intrigues against him in Prague. He protected Dee at Trebon, which is about an hour's drive from here, which we'll have a chance to go to, those who wish, on Tuesday. And he's really a remarkable figure. I think that this gathering is probably the first significant opportunity to focus upon alchemy, Kabbalah, Hermetic philosophy since Willem and his brother were really active in the late 16th and early 17th century, pretty much as a contemporary of Shakespeare at the time of the Emperor Rudolf II. So I just find it very pertinent and synchronistic that Willem will be gazing down on us throughout this event. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Nicholas Goodrich Clark. Is he here? Pleasure to introduce Nicholas Goodrich Clark. He was the editor of the Essential Readings series, which published a series of volumes on John Dee, Paracelsus, Jacob Boehme, Robert Fludd, and various other individuals. He himself is the author of a couple of books, one on Paracelsus, and another one on the occult roots of Nazism, which he certainly approached in a very scholarly and rigorous way. He has traveled throughout Central Europe, really, for the last 25 years, and was virtually the only person I spoke to before this conference had ever been to Český Krumlov before this gathering. So it's a real pleasure to have him here, and please welcome Nicholas Goodrich Clark.
Thank you very much indeed. As I rose yesterday morning at our farmhouse in the darkness before dawn, I was ever mindful of the opening verses in The Chemical Wedding. They're over here. This day, this the royal wedding is. Art thou thereto by birth inclined, and unto joy of God designed? Then mayst thou to the mountain tend, whereon three stately temples stand, and there see all from end to end. Keep watch and ward, thyself regard, unless with diligence thou bathe, the wedding canst thou harmless save. He'll damage have that here delays. Let him beware to light that weighs. And underneath the words, sponsors and sponsor, husband and wife. This is the central mystery of the chemical wedding. And I must say it's also the central mystery of the Rosicrucian furore, the Rosicrucian enigma. And as I traveled to Prague with my wife, Claire, I was constantly reminded that there was, in fact, a deeper spirit behind our gathering here. It is really a tribute to Ralph White and the New York Open Center that we are gathered today, over 100 of us, nearly 400 years after the original Rosicrucian Manifesto's publication, to celebrate, to discuss, and above all, to envision what that new age meant then and what it might mean for us today. It is a rare opportunity, and as I stood at the concourse at Prague Airport and saw the flights coming in from all over the world, from Toronto, New York, from Brussels, from London, from Pisa, from Rome, I couldn't help thinking, in our day and age, is it extraordinary that brothers and sisters, men and women, should stream from all parts of the world again to hear about the Rosicrucians and what they did over 400 years ago. And we are gathered together, and I think this is a really rare opportunity to celebrate that Christian community that in fact gathered in Central Europe during that brief period of opportunity and promise. May our hearts be pure, and may we think again of how we may, in fact, preserve that new age, that promise of a Christian Europe. As many of you will know, the Rosicrucian manifestos were originally published in the first decade or so of the 17th century. Johann Valentin Andreae, a Protestant theologian and churchman of Württemberg, that's to say Swabia in southwest Germany, is accounted responsible for the chemical wedding that was published in 1616 at Strasbourg by Zetzner, a well-known occult, alchemical, and theosophical publisher of Strasbourg of the early 17th century. The Pharma and Confessio are not reliably attributed, although it is thought, and indeed the ensuing debate of the period 1620s onwards, does indicate that Andrea was also their author, although this is still contested. The interesting thing about the manifestos, for my purposes, is that they have strange references to an earlier period, a period that extends back to the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries. And as the title of my paper entails, I am concerned with the Rosicrucian prelude, and in particular, John Dee's mission to Central Europe in the late 16th century. Let us look at the Pharma and Confessio and the chemical wedding very briefly in order to understand what references, what clues, what hints there might be to what I call the prelude. The Pharma, which was originally published in 1612, although it was known to be circulating in manuscript in 1610, was subtitled Allgemeine und generale Reformation der ganzen weiten Welt, beneben der Pharma Fraternitatis des löblichen Orden des Rosenkreuzes. So, the fame, the general and universal reformation of the whole wide world, next to the fame of the fraternity of the esteemed order of Rosenkreuz. Now, the interesting references in this paper concern, a brief biography or description of one Christian Rosenkreuz, who was accounted the father of this mysterious order. It describes how, as a young man, he was born, it's already stated, in the late 14th century, the fictitious date, perhaps, that's given for him, he was born in 1378. And at the age of six, he was already learned, sent away to school, proficient in Latin and other subjects. At the age of 16, he already decided on a holy pilgrimage to the Holy Land. He was accompanied by an older brother, that might have been a religious brother, to Cyprus, and there this brother died. We can imagine this man, who may not even have existed, stranded in Cyprus, age 16, without the man that accompanied him. He decided to persevere in his journey, and he came into the Levant, that's to say the Holy Land, at that time clearly under the Turks, because in those days the Turks were already growing up from the Levant and northern Africa towards the Balkans. That map, incidentally, dates from 1550, and I'll be talking about that in the context of John Dee's travels, but at this point we should remember the Turks were already spreading up from the Levant. Christian Rosenkreuz therefore traveled into the Holy Land that was under Islamic suzerainty. He never got to Jerusalem. How is it that a pilgrim never gets to Jerusalem? Instead, he enjoyed honors amongst the Turks due to his proficiency in physic. A man of 16, already proficient in physic, and admired for that by the Turks. He dwelt amongst the wise men of Damascus, and in due course, the wise men of Damascus advised that he travel on to others in Egypt. And so he made his way, for two or three years, through the Ottoman Empire of the northern coast of Africa, and then taking ship further to Fez, where he was advised that others would tell him further mysteries. They accounted him, of course, a worthy recipient of their knowledge because he, as I've already said, was proficient in physic and therefore regarded, obviously, as a member of that special group of Europeans in the late 14th century who knew something about nature and its wider implications. From Morocco, Fez, the northern part of the Ottoman Empire in northern Africa, he proceeded to Spain. We must now imagine that this visionary Christian Rosenkreutz, and as I say, perhaps imaginary personality, was in his mid-20s. It was now probably in the early 15th century, around the time of Henry V in England and Emperor Sigismund in the Holy Roman Empire. He spent some time in Spain, a country that was saturated by the interaction of Muslim, Christian, and Jewish Kabbalic influence. After all, it is there that Raymond Lull was writing in the 13th century in Catalonia, and not so far, of course, from the troubadour culture of Occitania, bringing these strands together. And the implication, of course, in the Rosicrucian manifestos is that Christian Rosenkreutz in the early 15th century was again exposed to those precious and extraordinary influences radiating from the two other cultures of Eurasia, Judaism and Islam, as well as our Christian civilization. And eventually comes back to Germany, because he is a German, a Dutchman, blonde and big of aspect, we are described. In Germany, he decides to found an order. We don't know the date of that order exactly, but he called unto him 8 brothers. We only know their names through their initials. I won't go into all of them, but there is one from the manuscripts that might have been corrupted. It is I-O, and it's easy to read an O for a D. And of course, it's always easy to read an I for a J. Johannes, Ionis. Was this John Dee? Well, it may have been in someone's imagination when they came to write these manuscripts. But it wouldn't have been for the dates, because this is already 100 years or so before John Dee's life. But the interesting thing about that I-O is that he lived in England. He was one of the brothers that resided in England, and he was also well known at court, and was held responsible for the cure of a young Duke of Norfolk from leprosy. So Christian Rosenkreutz surely gathered unto him men who were again proficient in physic, widely learned in the book of nature, and were able to effect marvelous and wonderful cures. The other 8 brothers, the other 7, of course, were duly replaced by others. Now at the age of 81, a ripe old age, one might think, Christian Rosenkreutz married. That's a fictitious date, of course, for the chemical wedding, because the third manifesto, if you like, of Johann Valentin Andrea, Die chemische Hochzeit Christiani Rosenkreutz, anno 1459. This is the one that contains this extraordinary verse. And may I just for a moment take the modern translation by my dear friend Jocelyn Godwin, because I find the modern translation perhaps even more exciting for our own. Today, today, today is the wedding of the king. If you are born for this, chosen by God for joy, you may ascend the mount whereon 3 temples stand and see the thing yourself. Take heed, observe yourself. If you're not clean enough, the wedding can work ill. Perjure here at your peril. Who is light? Beware. Christian Rosenkreutz died, according to the text, in 1484, at the age of 106, which is nice to know that he had at least some long life before him, if indeed he enjoyed it in marriage. He was buried by the other brothers and laid in a special vault and really forgotten for at least 100 years. And it's the discovery of this vault, ostensibly again, if we're to follow the fiction or the story of this text through of the chemical wedding, where he was discovered in 1604, a date that I will come to explain is surely pregnant with apocalyptic prophecy and hopes in early 17th century Europe. They found Christian Rosenkreutz in a vault surrounded by the most wonderful things, lamps that burnt eternally. Well, you see them in Christian churches today, we know about that. Strange books, the vocabula of learned Theophrastus, Hohenheim, Bombastus, otherwise Paracelsus, It's interesting that of all the books that were named, besides our Holy Bible that lay in the vault of Rosenkreuz, Andreae and the authors of the Pharma and Confessio, if they are not he, should have mentioned the works of Paracelsus. They open the vault, and thereby was understood a revelation for the early 17th century. And it's probable, I think, if we look back and think about this, in terms of its authorship in 1617, with the Rosicrucian manifestos embroidering the fiction of Rosenkreuz's life, his works, his career around medieval Europe and Asia and Northern Africa. If we think about this, it's very easy to see some sort of pseudepigraphic tradition which is ascribing to Christian Rosenkreuz, again, possibly a fictitious character, all the hopes, all the expectations, and the summum of the learning that was embroidered in the other mind of Europe. That is to say, the Hermetic mind, the Paracelsian mind, the mind of Europe that was to be gently but firmly supplanted in the 17th century by empirical, psychic, Hermetic, Hermeticism, a Florentine tradition that began in the mid. But it's interesting to ponder for a moment on his own origins. He was the son of Johann Andreae. Johann was born on the 12th of March, 1554, again in Swabia at Göppingen, a place where Paracelsus was active and had his laboratories in the early 16th century. So only a matter of 30 years before Andreae was born, Paracelsus was active in Göppingen with his own laboratory and assistants. The father of Andreae was deacon and inspector at Herrenberg before becoming abbot at Königsbrunn, where he completed a distinguished Lutheran career and died on the 9th of August, 1601, a short while before his own son began the composition and imagination of these Rosicrucian manifestos. More importantly yet than Andreae's father is his grandfather, Jacob Andreae. Jacob Andreae was known as the Luther of Swabia. He was born on the 25th of March, 1528, at Weiblingen, again in Württemberg. And he was perhaps, and rightly, accounted the most famous Lutheran theologian of Southwest Germany. He was an accomplished poet. He was proficient in many languages. And the extraordinary thing is that he was counted on for a great deal of advice from the Duke, as indeed was his grandson. Andreae's heritage has passed to us today, though unwittingly, not even in the manifestos, but in popular culture. Swabia. I don't know if many of you know Swabia, but it's a land of rolling hills, of beautiful valleys. It is really the most dreamy and romantic area of southwestern Germany. Contained within it, of course, is the Black Forest. I was fortunate enough to spend my student days there and also worked on the railways in Swabia, where I often drove for long distances as a stoker on the railways. And it was extraordinary at that time because one really did encounter the countryside and learnt the Swabian tongue from ordinary men working on the footplate. But the real mystery of it was the pietism, the Christian pietist tradition of Swabia. Because Andreae's tradition of Lutheran Protestant theology, and above all his poetry, because Andreae was a poet, The Chemical Wedding is a work of poetry, and he was an accomplished poet. This is Lutheranism plus poetry, very imaginative mode of teaching in the Christian tradition. That poetry has passed on to others. In the 18th century, the names of Johann Albrecht Bengel, in the early 18th century, a biblical exegete and a theologian, and above all, Johann Friedrich Christoph Oettinger, perhaps the most famous Christian theosophist of the mid-18th century. Theosophy with a small t, following in the tradition of Jakob Böhme and others before their, should we say, popularization by Madame Blavatsky in the late 19th century under her own aegis. These theosophists of Swabia were keeping alive a spirit of a fiery heart, a heart that radiated an inner knowledge, a mystical conversion. They followed in a tradition of learning, of education of ordinary boys and girls in schools. Because other pietists like Jakob Spener and Franke founded great schools and boarding schools for boys in Halle, in Leipzig, and other centers of 17th century Germany. And their traditions, again, mellifluously mixed with the Baroque, created that rich strain of mysticism that you see in Oettinger and Benger. And where does this lead to our own day? It leads to Hermann Hesse. Many of us, I think, who were born in the 40s and 50s, know only too well how popular Hesse became in the 60s. And Hesse, again, was the child, the son of German Protestant churchmen and missionaries in Germany and India. And it is from him, Hesse, that we get to rich tradition of Swabian pietism that goes back to Andrea and the chemical wedding. It is suffused, of course, with a Hindu and Buddhistical understanding of the mysteries of yeast that made Hesse so popular on the campuses of North America in the 1960s. But what we see in Hesse is a tradition of Swabian pietism. It is deeply Christian. And the interesting thing about it is that Hesse, in his famous magnum opus, The Glass Bead Game, published during the war in 1942 in Swiss exile, far from the conflict and fiasco of our modern Europe, he described this Castilia, this promised land, and in it he placed Josef Knecht. And Josef Knecht, in order to obtain admission to the magical order of Castilia, had to write three essays. One was on Bengel, one was on Oettinger, and the third was never finished. I would like to suppose it might have been on Andrea. But that was Hesse's tradition, and it's something I think many of us share, because all of us at some stage in the 1960s heard about Hesse, if only we saw his titles in a San Diego bookstore. The manifestos also contain many strange references that have been attributed to John Dee, and it's here that I begin my real discussion of the prelude and its importance to Germany. The references are several. In the first place, it's curious that Francis Yates, to whom we owe this pioneering study of the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, which in many ways has served us as a spur to our meeting here, discusses how the Confessio and Pharma contain rather strange clues. Firstly, she mentions that in the Pharma there are references to Paracelsus, which I've already mentioned. Coming to something more relevant to D, we have two or three curious references. They are very slender, but they are sufficient to trace something of the background of 16th century Hermeticism into the Rosicrucian manifestos. The first, which I'll start with because it's so telling, is this poem that I've already read several times. Beside it, printed in the chemical wedding of the Strasbourg edition of 1617, and in all subsequent versions, is this strange sigil. In the German version, you see it's like a little horned man with legs and a cross, and here it is more obviously recognizable as a complex hieroglyph. A circle with a central point, surmounted by a crescent, and surmounted with a cross and two semicircles. There is absolutely no doubt this is the Monus Hieroglyphica of John Dee. Before I go into the Monas, I should mention one other strange connection between the manifestos and the work of John Dee. Bound together with the Confessio, indeed published together with it, was another work. And the books were published by Zetzner clearly as a work that was supposed to be read in its entirety. In fact, the full title of the Confessio, the second manifesto of 1615, is Secretioris Philosophia Consideratio Brevis, so the short consideration of the secret philosophy, according to Philip Agabella, et nunc primum una cum confessione fraternitatis arasi. In other words, a brief consideration of the secret philosophy according to Philip Agabella, and now for the first time, the confession of a brotherhood of Rosenkreuz. Two things strike one about this work. First of all, the second manifesto, the Confessio, is prefaced at length with this brief consideration of the secret philosophy of Philip Agabella. Philip Agabella has never been identified, though the work was dedicated to Bruno Carolus Uffel, and I'm presently on the track of whom Philip Agabella may be, given this recommendation to a known dignitary. But I think it's more likely that Philip Agabella may be pseudepigraphic. He may not have even existed, because it's some sort of conceit. Philip Agabella sounds remarkably like Philip the Kabbalist or Philip of Kabbalah. And again, I think we can be talking about a literary conceit indicating the origins. And secondly, on the verso title page is the quote from Genesis chapter 26, De rore coeli et pinguidirai terrae det tibi deus. God will give you the dew of heaven and the bread of the earth. Two references in the Confessio. The one, this long work, that is the secret consideration of the Kabbalistic secret philosophy of Philip Agabella. And the second, this extraordinary quote. Well, the point is that both those are utterly inspired by John Dee. The brief consideration of the secret philosophy, according to Philip Agabella, is no more than a paraphrase of John Dee's Monas Hieroglyphica of 1564. He quotes in extenso, passage for passage. Philip Agabella was either a plagiarist or a popularizer, but whatever, he is clearly Dee speaking side by side to the Confessio. And secondly, the title page verso dedication, this quote from Genesis 27. God will give you the dew of heaven and the bread of the earth. It's this very quote that adorned the front cover, the title page, of John Dee's Monas Hieroglyphica of 1564. De rore coeli et pinguide terrae debit et tibi deus. Genesis 27. So much so that this play on De rore coeli, dew of heaven in Latin, ros, dew, gave rise to the idea that the dew of heaven might even be the ros, the dew of God. Again, a literary idea, possibly one worth further exploring. My interest at this point is simply to show the strong influence of John Dee coming out in the early 17th century in the manifestos that we, in fact, identify as the crucial key to Rosicrucian literature and its subsequent popularization through the 18th and 19th centuries up until the present. So having mentioned those instances of John Dee, before I discuss John Dee in further detail, I should just mention one other thing that indicates John Dee. In the subsequent Rosicrucian furore, when in fact the king and queen of Bohemia had been vanquished, the disaster at the Battle of the White Mountain in 1620 was complete, and there was a vitriolic literature on the part of Habsburgs and the Austrians, the Counter-Reformation, denouncing this Protestant adventurism in Bohemia, you find this engraving. The reasons and origin of all our suffering and misery. And here is the Palatine, Frederick, who was married to King James's daughter, Elizabeth of Bohemia, standing on a Y, which is again mounted on a Z. It's a curious symbol, and again one that has some significance once we realize the Greek and Hermetic derivations of these large letters, which are to be found also in the Monas Hieroglyphica of John Dee in 1564, a description of a Pythagorean Y and its measures and distances. I'll come into this now as I discuss John Dee's life. John Dee was, I think, quite justifiably regarded as a leading light of the Tudor Renaissance under Queen Elizabeth. He was born on the 13th of July, 1527, in London. son of one Roland D, a Welsh courtier at the court of King Henry VIII. The fact that Roland D was a Welshman, in fact that John D was always proud of his Welsh ancestry, is significant for us in as much as the Tudors that had come to the throne in 1485 following the victory of Henry Tudor, King Henry VII of England, had concluded our Wars of the Roses, which was, of course, a battle of attrition between the competing houses of York and Lancaster, and brought about a centralized, unified state in England for the first time, after the, you might say, passing of merry old medieval England, when barons and nobles could get on their horses and declare UDI in various parts of the country. The Tudor state was the beginning of the English state as we know it. At that time was laid the basis of libraries, of administration, of a civil service, of a united kingdom that we rejoice in today by the same name. The funny thing about this Tudor period is that it didn't come from England. Henry Tudor was a mystery man, if you like, a bit of an outstart, because his grandfather was Owen Tudor, and the very name, as you'll recognize, is Celtic. The Tudors came from Wales. Of course, they were related to the royal house by John of Gaunt in the 14th century. But the Tudors came from outside and imposed order on merry medieval England that had been long since exhausted by these constant squabbles above the barons of York and Lancaster. And the fact that they came from a Celtic fringe country like Wales was interesting for John Dee, because he spent a great deal of time tracing his own ancestry through Geoffrey of Monmouth's Historia of the Kings of England, Britain, I should say, because all the Celtic lands were included, and indeed, on several occasions, passed memoranda to the Queen herself, with whom he enjoyed a close and intimate relationship, describing their common ancestry and possible relationship over hundreds of years in the distant past. Other writers have suggested that John Dee was obsessed with the Queen, and in fact Gustav Meyrink, whom I'll be talking about tomorrow, went so far as to suggest that he in fact was enamored of her and hoped thereby to gain the throne of England as her consort. But as I say, that's another story. John Dee was remarkable. He could only hope for the hand of the Queen of England if he was somebody, and John Dee certainly was somebody. His portrait hangs today in the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford. And we're very fortunate to be living near Oxford because we have considerable access to the remains of John Dee, not only his portrait, but also his manuscripts and books that were collected by Elias Ashmole and found under mysterious circumstances from a grocer in the city of London in the 1630s and 40s. And there they were brought to Oxford, transcribed, edited, and their originals and the book versions can still be read in Duke Humphrey's library today, where I spent the last week making some rather amazing revelations that I hope to share with you before the end of this talk. John Dee was schooled at Cambridge. His father was, of course, of sufficient means and well known at court to afford a good education for his son, and so he went to St. John's College, Cambridge, in 1542. He studied diligently. His own account leaves us in no doubt that this was the sort of young man who could study 18 to 19 hours a day, setting aside a further hour for food and drink, and four for sleep. He loved his studies, but he was drawn to a different kind of learning compared to the trivium of the universities of the country at that time. The master of his college, Sir John Cheek, was a mathematician, but that was frowned on because mathematics was something actually rather new and strange, or even worse. It had its roots in medieval theology. Sir John Cheek was best known as a professor of Greek at Cambridge, and indeed that is the subject that John Dee ultimately became proficient in, was offered a fellowship at Trinity College, Cambridge, which had just been founded by King Henry VIII in 1548 at the conclusion of his studies. So there we have a brilliant student. Before he's even taken his MA, he's offered a fellowship as an under-lecturer in Greek at King Henry's New College. And Trinity College, as you may know, if you visited Cambridge, is perhaps the most magnificent of our Cambridge colleges. It's conceived on a vast scale, a Renaissance college in every sense, a testament to the Tudor Renaissance in our country. But John Dee was not satisfied by academic laurels. He sought more. He sought a knowledge that would go further behind the humanism of the Renaissance. Because in many ways, John Dee was a transitional figure, and that's what makes him so interesting to us. He made him such a prophet of the new age. The universities were changing very fast because once King Henry broke with Rome in 1538 and started to dissolve the monasteries, there was a veritable fever of trying to destroy the past in line with a new humanism. This wasn't destructive, but it was humanistic and very forward-looking, perhaps too much so. Monasteries were broken up, icons destroyed, images broken, libraries laid waste. At this time, most of Merton Library was taken away from Merton College and burnt by the cartload because it contained works of a strange nature, diagrams, pictures, formulae, not witchcraft, no. Our greatest philosophers that maintain the tradition of Platonism at Oxford, Roger Bacon and Greathead, the first chancellor of the university we know by name, they were scientists, medieval scientists, and their pictures were of strange inventions, of flying machines, of calculations, of mathematics. It was a tradition that was, of course, far deeper than the trivium that was taught in humanistic curriculum, when everyone was more concerned with Latin authors, rhetoric, grammar, polished poetry. These men were scientists, and that's what John Dee was interested in, maths, science, the older writers. He couldn't believe his eyes when he saw those libraries being destroyed. He was fortunate because he managed to acquire quite a lot of them. The extraordinary thing about the Reformation at that time, under King Edward, is that it actually started to take away a lot of the older learning. It was just regarded as stuff for the bonfire. Duke Humphrey's, the foundation of our Bodleian Library at Oxford, is full of manuscripts collected by Duke Humphrey of Gloucester. By the end of the 15th and early 16th century, it's gone. It's not there. The Bodleian Library had to be refounded by Sir Thomas Bodley in the late 16th, early 17th century. But John Dee had got there first. He'd bought up a great deal of Duke Humphrey's library. And he wrote a treatise to Queen Mary, who succeeded King Edward IV, appealing for the foundation of a British museum and a British library. That is to say that John Dee is in many ways the precursor of our own British Museum, a British Library in London that wasn't started, of course, till the late 18th, early 19th century. Sir Thomas Bodley's library in Oxford, of course, predates that. But Dee got there first. He bought back most of Duke Humphrey's manuscripts. And he bought others. He was an indefatigable traveler on the continent. No sooner had he taken his bachelor's degree in 1548 and been awarded this fellowship at Trinity College than he was off to the continent. He went to Louvain, to the Low Countries, where Renaissance humanism and older scientific learning was permitted, indeed encouraged. There he met a variety of cartographers, people who were interested in maths, astronomy, navigation. He met Gerardus Mercator. We should know Mercator, of course, from Mercator's projection, which is, in fact, perhaps one of the most common projections in school atlases that we remember seeing when we first went to school. And, of course, they're utterly current. Mercator was years ahead of his time in maths and navigation and astronomy. And John Dee wanted to sit at his feet in the Low Countries rather than study Latin and Ciceronian prose in Cambridge. In due course, he prepared a book called General and Rare Memorials Pertaining to the Perfect Art of Navigation. If you have time after this lecture, take a closer look at this picture because it's extraordinary. Not only in this work does John Dee blend an understanding of navigation and astronomy based on his profound work on Euclid, he also combines it with extraordinary ideas relating to our Elizabethan empire and the foundations of the British Empire. This boat bears on it the Latin word Europa, but it's written in Greek, and above this lady sitting at the helm is the word Elizabeth. Other allegorical symbolism in this picture undeniably bears testament to John Dee's close advice at that time concerning voyages of exploration under Sir Henry Frobisher. And in the text, we learn of his backing of the Muscovy Company, his involvement with Sir Francis Drake's circumnavigation of the world in 1588, and above all, his search for the northeastern passage to Cathay, or China, the Far East. John Dee's science was useful to the Elizabethans. It was the foundations of the British Empire in the sense of exploration, trade, discovery. But it was backed by science, a a science that our older universities were not teaching, indeed have almost lost at that time. John Dee was on his own. Offers rained upon him of professorships in Oxford and Cambridge, also in Paris and the Low Countries, but he had set his heart on something greater, some knowledge of God's universe, profound knowledge that couldn't be gathered from books or in the schools. And perhaps this was his greatest temptation. During the 1550s, he'd returned to England after further travels, and after a brief period of imprisonment due to some fracas with Sir Edmund Bonner, the reactionary Archbishop of London under Queen Mary, which involved possible charges of witchcraft because he was asked to cast horoscopes for Queen Mary and also for Queen Elizabeth. And of course, it was rather a political imbroglio because Mary was on the throne for a very short time and her half-sister Elizabeth was only just waiting to get onto the throne. So John Dee's advice concerning their horoscopes had profound political significance. He was out of custody very shortly afterwards, and he then started his publications. The Pro De Muta Aphoristica of 1558 is significant because it introduces the monad for the first time, this symbol that we encounter in the chemical wedding of the Rosicrucian manifestos in 1617. So there, over 75 years earlier, we find in one of John Dee's first major published works, the Pro Pede Muta Aphoristica of 1558, we find ID, his monogram, either side of this monad, this holy hieroglyph. And again, it is the main subject, it is the title subject of his work of 1564 that he dedicated to Emperor Maximilian II here in Europe, the Habsburg Emperor, after seeing him crowned King of Hungary in Pressburg, Bratislava. The pages of the Monas Hieroglyphica are extremely interesting. Although they are very obscure, my research is based here largely on the work of Nicholas Cluley, who has rendered us an enormous service in his work, John Dee's Natural Philosophy, that's been recently published. We have discussions of the Pythagorean eye, the choice of whether one shall be subject to tyranny and the way of the world, or pneumatikos, or the way of the spirit. How there are far many more people in the world who are devoted to the world of material, and tyrannos, the world of power, and importance, and vanity, and how there are so fewer who are devoted to the spirit, and a rather complex system of mathematics working out how many there are of each kind, and what expectations there might be of the future world. And here a rather funny symbol of a Pythagorean Y being tended by learned men, scholars and craftsmen, those proficient in alchemy with their laboratories, and those proficient in learning sitting on a throne, and those that fall into the fire because they are touched by fire, having worked too hard in their alchemical laboratories. There's no doubt that the Monas Hieroglyphica is a very complex astrological, hermetic, and cabalistic symbol. If we take the Monas apart, we find that it relates to the seven revolutions. Here they are, the planets from our Earth in a terracentric vision of the universe, through the planets going outwards from Mercury, Venus, Mars. Celestial and astrological influence upon our Earth. And then the formation of this. And here we find a very interesting comparison of a sephirothic or Kabbalistic diagram that I found from another pansophic work of the late 16th century, which indicates very clearly how John Dee and others were thinking together of glyphs, hieroglyphs, that could summarize some theory of the universe. Theory of everything, if you will, which combined astrology, Kabbalah, and theology, a knowledge of God, in some kind of pansophy, some kind of general wisdom regarding God's work and universe. This kind of work was what John Dee was doing up until the 1580s. It's profound, It's very learned, and above all, it's based on his library, perhaps the most famous library of Elizabethan England. That library, as I said, was crammed full of manuscripts that he'd bought from libraries that were being broken up in Oxford and amongst private collections, hauled away by the cartload, suspected of containing papistical formulae. Well, as a result of his library, he enjoyed enormous patronage. He regularly wrote to William Cecil, Lord Baron Burleigh. He was a close friend of Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester. He was his tutor while Dudley was a young man. And Dudley was ever a valued advocate of Dee at court. If Dee wanted to speak with the Queen, whether at Westminster or Richmond, or even have her barge stop at the bankside at Mortlake, where he lived in his house, Dudley would arrange it. With Philip Sidney, perhaps that most amazing meteor of the Elizabethan realm, Dee was intimate and friendly. Dee had access to all these men. They revered Dee, and above all, they thought his library was perhaps the most important resource that Britain had at its disposal, the very match of learning on the continent for this hermetic and strange philosophy that was combining a mathematical tradition of the Middle Ages with Florentine Neoplatonism of the mid and late Renaissance. Everything would have continued like this had Dee not wanted more, and perhaps this is Dee's tragedy. Dee could have been content with those professorships at Oxford and Cambridge, Paris. He said in Paris when he lectured at the age of 22 that the professors and students of Paris and from nearby Low Countries, in fact, attended the lecture halls perhaps twice as large as this, as large as the examination schools in Oxford, and they had to stand outside the doors or climb up to the windows in order to hear what Dee was saying. So interested were they in Dee's exposition of Euclid's mathematics at that time. And when he came to publish, he was sought out by all the mathematicians and philosophers of Europe. The list is quite extraordinary, just how well regarded Dee was in Europe at the time. Sometimes when I think of Dee, I'm reminded of the dangers of those that want to go too far. There's always a tendency that we can burn our wings if we seek God's knowledge by unwise paths. Because John Dee was surely blessed in his gifts. He had really everything going for him. By the time he lectured in Paris at the age of 23, men such as Arontius, the renowned geographer and Regius professor of mathematics at the Collège de Paris in France, Brancontius, the famous lawyer and distinguished philosopher, mathematician, antiquarian, president of the Parliament in Paris, Tenabus, the highly respected classicist and hermeticist, men in their mid-40s, 50s, 60s, men at the summit of their profession in learning, they sought out this young man of 23, 24 and said, "Well, that's extraordinary, how do you know these things? How did you, that's amazing." And they wanted to talk with him so much. That's why the lecture halls were crowded. Dee's reputation on the continent was tremendous. And we should bear that in mind when I come to his journey, his mission to the continent. John Dee was as famous, it's an invidious comparison, but he was as famous as a nuclear physicist in the mid-20th century before World War II, sought out by presidents and men of power because they need those secrets, they need that science, for good or ill. We should see Dee in that light. He's a man whose science was of worldwide implication, just like nuclear science is of worldwide implication in our own. Peter Ramus, the opponent, an important Aristotelian and educational reformer, also sought out Dee's acquaintance. Gabrielus Postellus, professor of maths and philosopher of Paris, who later taught at Venice. Famous as an Orientalist and a Kabbalist, he dreamed of establishing a world religion that would combine the factions of the Protestant schism and Catholicism. That, of course, was an interest that haunted Dee. He, too, wanted to overcome the decision, dissent and schism of the Reformation. He thought like a Reformation man. Of course, he was a Protestant, inasmuch as he clearly wished to actually have freedom for learning. He was deeply pious. His work as a theologian was profoundly pious and had many Catholic reminiscences in terms of opening prayers, thanksgivings, and all sorts of rituals and practices that we can only understand in the light of his Catholic upbringing. But above all, he wanted to transcend both in a unified theology, a dream that, of course, went back to Nicholas of Cusa, of Pope Urban II, men who wished to unite Christendom as early as the 14th and 15th century, men like Pope Urban II, who even suggested to the Sultan of the Turks that he convert to Christianity and become emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire all over again. It's an amazing idea, but ideas that in fact may surround us now at this moment of how the three religions of the book, of Islam, of Judaism and Christianity, may yet find common ground for a Western Eurasian synthesis. These were the ideas that inspired the Irenists, Nicholas of Cusa, Pope Urban II, and by implication, John Dee. They dreamed of a world religion. Now, everything would have continued fine, as I say, had John Dee not wanted to do more, go further. There is an element of Faust in this, a Dr. Faustus, someone who wants to, in fact, gain a shortcut, someone who wants the secrets on the cheap. Well, they're not that cheaply bought. This was a young man who stayed up all night in order to master maths and science. This is a young man who traveled the schools of Europe, seeking out men and books, rare libraries and manuscripts in order to achieve that learning. A man who is also not content with professorships and the laurels of a steady job as a professor of a faculty. Somebody who wanted to go right to the top. Someone who, yes, hung out with men of power, like Dudley, like William Cecil, like Walsingham, Queen Elizabeth's Chief of Intelligence and Secret Service. These were the men that Dee looked to. He looked to power. He looked to men who could get him where he needed to go, because he had something so important. He couldn't just talk to students. It was something like nuclear science. You just had to go to the president. You just had to discuss it with people who could make things happen. John Dee, in 1582, probably reached some kind of impasse in his life. It's said that his financial circumstances were unsteady. The two livings that he'd received from King Edward VI as a result of representations on the part of Cecil and Dudley on the basis of two treatises he'd submitted to the king when he was a young man. They were two rectories, one in Upton-on-Severn in Gloucestershire and one at Longleddenham in Lincolnshire. And they provided quite a nice income. I mean, if you didn't want to teach at university, well, you didn't have to if you, in fact, had some nice tithes coming in from rectories and parishes in two parts of England. But due to some kind of Elizabethan cabal, it's suggested that it might be that Dee could not wholly enjoy the Queen's favour. Perhaps they were trying to squeeze him out. Perhaps he was an embarrassment. I don't know. But he lost those two rectories. He failed to get them recertificated. He had debts. And at the same time, he had extraordinary opportunities. In March 1582, a man had come to him, a very suspicious man, called Edward Kelly. And Edward Kelly brought with him three things that fascinated Dee. The Book of St. Dunstan, an old alchemical text that Edward Kelly, this visitor in the middle of the night, had claimed to find somewhere in Wales, or perhaps in the abbey grounds of the dissolved monastery of Glastonbury in Somerset, and two powders of projection, a red powder and a white powder, powders of projection that might in fact contain the means of transmuting base metals into gold and silver. Well, Dee was fascinated. This sounded like somewhere where he hadn't been before. And perhaps like Faust, he welcomed that black poodle into his room. Not once, not twice, but three times he asked this black poodle, Kelly, to come into the room. And this is the beginning of that extraordinary partnership between John Dee, the crystal gazer or scryer, and his assistant, Edward Kelly. In a way, it's a long way from the respected John Dee of the Tudor Renaissance. But the fact is, the pictures, of course, reflect the twin imaginations. Here is Dee, respectable, the summit of scholarship, of learning, of patronage, the Elizabethan Dee, the friend of princes, of emperors. And here is a private Dee, the Dee of a rancorous polemic published in the 17th century. Dr. Dee avoucheth his stone is brought by angelical ministry. This was the crystal ball that Edward Kelly had enabled him to find in his rooms at Mortlake as they sat one evening. And Kelly told him Behold, an angel is at the western window, and a little lower between those books. See, the angel ill has left something. Go, Master D, see a moment what is between those books in the dusk. And John D, this incredibly learned, this man who had respect all over the continent, was he just falling for a clever impostor? He goes over there, and amongst the books, he finds the famous crystal ball. Yes, Dr. D avoucheth that his ball was brought by angelic ministry. And next to him, here, Edward Kelly. No doubt a very educated, a very clever man, a seer, a conjurer, an alchemist. Really, the sort of man that we all want to meet, because he's so clever and interesting. He's a very naughty man, too. You've got to be very clever with naughty men, because sometimes they can find things for you that they want you to find, like crystal balls in the dust by the window. And at the same time, they have a naughty past. And Edward Kelly certainly had a naughty past. He was born around 1550. He was younger than Dee. So that when he appeared at Dee's house in the middle of the night, he was only 32 years old. He made a most frightening impression. He wore a black skull cap, and his ears were cropped. He had no ears. And the reason is they'd been cropped, which was a common punishment for forgery in Elizabethan England. And the story is that he'd gone up to Oxford. His father was an apothecary, which might explain his alchemical interests. Edward Kelly had gone up to Oxford to study at possibly Worcester College because of his association by birth in the city of Worcester. But he'd been sent down pretty quickly. Perhaps he too didn't settle for what the professors had to offer, and made his way up to the north in Lancaster, where he became a scribe or a common clerk. Well, that was a fairly good occupation for someone who hadn't actually finished a degree at Oxford, and it might have been an opportunity for Kelly to pursue his real interests while he just did a day job in some local bureaucracy. The thing about the day job is that he probably didn't play by the rules, and that's why he got his ears cropped for forgery. Because if you're working in Chancery at the time, it was very easy to make use of wills, chronicles, and other documents. And there's a lot of gain if you can forge a will, and I'm sure Edward Kelly wouldn't have been beyond that. What he did when he wasn't working on his day job was even darker and stranger. He was interested in necromancy, the raising of the dead. And there is this extraordinary engraving that dates from a later period, which shows Edward Kelly, together with one Paul Waring, raising the dead at the church of Walton le Dale in Lancashire. This is long before he met Dee. But the point is, Kelly's reputation was unsavory. It was extraordinary. It was suffused with Elizabethan magic and witchcraft. And this was a man, John Dee, a man of the Renaissance, a man of Ficinian Neoplatonism, welcomed into his rooms because it would take him further than no philosopher had gone before. It's interesting that this engraving showing Edward Kelly and Paul Waring surrounded by a magical circle in the graveyard of Walton le Dale in Lancashire with this rather protesting and you might say slightly sort of injured corpse that stood up from the grave in obedience to their summons, it comes from a book by Ebenezer Sibley in the early 19th century. That's the reason it's got this sort of gothic colouring, you know, strong verticals, the church, the stormy sky. And because there were a pair of men involved in this, Paul Waring and Edward Kelly, of course, subsequent scholarship has constantly said, this is John Dee and Edward Kelly raising the dead. But then, if you consort with people like Edward Kelly, you can't help being held account for what Edward Kelly was doing in his more remote past. What Kelly started to do with Dee were really very extraordinary things, and they involved magical sigils and circles. The preparations of magic squares. In order to summon the dead and the angels to tell them of the secrets of the universe. It was through Kelly's mediumship. I don't want you to understand this in a 19th century spiritualistic sense, because I think one or two people like Karl Kiesewetter and others have made this mistake of interpreting Kelly's activities in the tradition of mediumship or spiritualistic seances. That they were not. They were much more concerned with the invocation of angels In the tradition of Pseudo-Dionysius of the 7th century AD, the idea of penetrating the celestial hierarchies and the names of God in the super-celestial realm, above the celestial realm of planets, whereby one could actually call upon these lower names, Gabriel, Uriel, and other archangels, the names of God, and thereby receive the secrets of the universe. This is what Dee was after. Dee was after science as revealed by God's own messengers. This angelic language, I don't have time to go into it now, but what it involved was a holy table. This was transmitted by seances over a very long period, beginning in March 1582, when Kelly first burst into Dee's home, installed himself, much to Mrs. Dee's dislike, and started to become her husband's constant companion, a man you shadow, someone she could never get rid of. He was always there, the clever Kelly with the cropped ears, suggesting this in front of the crystal ball, learned dupe, deaf and blind, and listening to everything that Kelly saw vision through that crystal ball. It's an extraordinary thing, but this crystal ball is still today in the British Museum. That crystal ball is just a strange, slightly opaque, regular 2-inch crystal. And next to it is another instrument that was used by Dr. Dee, this obsidian disc with a handle made of black obsidian that had probably been brought by Spanish from the Aztecs in the 20s. All we have outside that, and this is a very valuable object, and it's on loan to me from Worcester College, is Dee's. And this is really, this was what Kelly actually kept himself, if you like, as a second hotline to God and the angels, when he wasn't working through the ball that he'd received through the western window and Angel Ill. This ball has quite a few air bubbles inside it. It was quite a crude implement, but it served Edward Kelly's needs, and it accompanied him throughout Central Europe during their mission. And it came to Worcester College from Trebon nearby, and the story of their spiritualistic transition to our understanding of the mission. Well, if I can quickly pass on to the mission, I'll really describe how important Central Europe at that time, because it's only by understanding its importance in Central Europe that we can understand how this extraordinary urge to contact the angels, to reach science in the super-celestial world, explains why it's taken so seriously by the then-time presidents of the world, the Emperor Rudolf II of Habsburg, the King of Poland, Stephen Batory, and perhaps even most importantly, because it was his first introduction, Albertus Łaski, the Prince of Syradia and the Palatine of Poland. It's these people that Dee sought out when things went bad for him financially in London in 1582. It's those people that he set out to find who would give him money and influence and power to continue his work on the continent where England, which has never fully realized and recognized the value of scholars and scientists compared to the continent, perhaps that is what Dee recognized at that point. Elizabeth had toyed with his interests, his speculations, his knowledge, but he'd never received proper remuneration to continue his research. He sought a world not unlike that of Paracelsus, a world where you had laboratories running day after day to make gold or silver, laboratories where you could explore the transmutations of the metals, laboratories where you could you could continue important alchemical research. And these things were available on the continent because following the death of Paracelsus in 1541, there was a tremendous activity in Bohemia and in Prague and in Poland and Krakow, in Silesia. There was a tremendous interest in alchemy from 1550 through to 1620. You might say this is a 70-year period of the alchemical dream, the chemical dream of the Renaissance, which comes to its fruition. And that's, in fact, what Dee came to find with all the power and patronage at the disposal of the leading figures on the continent. these documents, which I'm working from now, are quite extraordinary. Over the last week, when my wife Claire and I have been immured in the Bodleian Library, carrying out just a further, what we thought were going to be a few quick researches to put some final touches to our papers, we found some of the most extraordinary manuscripts and printed books which have not been properly evaluated to this day. The remaining part of my talk bears heavily and is based considerably on the pioneering research of my friend and colleague Bob Evans of Brasenose College, Oxford, and also those other scholars such as his own his own professor, Josef Polishensky of Prague, and other friends of his in Prague at the time when Bob was doing his pioneering work in the 1960s, such as Eliška Fuchikova, the Prague historian of art, and Rudolfine Prague, who's also here with us today. None of this work that I'm to tell you today could really have been done without Bob Evans's early work, but I think our discoveries over the last few weeks in the Bodleian Library will take us even further, and it's going to be these discoveries that are worthy of publication. Dee started off on this journey in 1583 in September due to the most exciting events in the summer. The Prince Łaski, that's L with a stroke through it in Polish, A-S-K-I, had come from his nobles, his family estates in Łask, which is on the high road between Breslau, now Wrocław, and Warszawa, around about here, not far from Łódź, to London. He'd come to London to seek important contacts with Elizabeth's court. He was, after all, the Palatine of Poland. That's to say, if you like, the king's right-hand man. This is King Stephen Bartory of Poland. And was also the possessor of vast estates stretching over all these areas of Poland. He, too, came from a most distinguished family. His uncle had been Archbishop of Gnezen. Gnezen is the archbiscopic of Poland, which goes back to the 9th century, and his father was Johann Łaski, and Johann Łaski was extraordinary in that he had been a diplomat to John Zapolje, who in fact became regent of Hungary under the protection of the Turks in 1541, when the Turks had taken Budapest, and Zapolje was elected a national king of Hungary in preference to the Habsburgs. And Zapolje had then sought the protection of the Turks in order to confront Habsburg with a national kingdom in Hungary. Prince Albert Łaski's father was that man who put himself at the service of John Zapolje, the national king of Hungary, together with the Turks, against Habsburg. And what's very interesting about that is we see, in fact, this early diplomatic history of Habsburg after the death of young King Louis on the battlefield of Mohacs in 1525, because due to a marriage contract between the family of Habsburg and the Kingdom of Spain and the kingdoms of Hungary, Habsburg would take the Kingdom of Spain, the throne of Spain, due to a marriage with Isabella, the mother of King Philip of Spain, and in the east, Habsburg would inherit the kingdoms of Bohemia and Hungary, if there was no male issue after King Ladislas. Once King Ladislas had given birth to a son, everyone thought that was all right. But the trouble was, young King Laszlo perished on the field of Mohacs, together with the flower of Magyar aristocracy in 1525-6. And as a result of that, Habsburg, that's to say Ferdinand I, inherited the throne of Hungary and Bohemia as the son-in-law of the Polish king. Now, what happened at this moment was that Prince Łaski, who came to Elizabeth's court in 1583, 50 years after these events, was an anti-Habsburg intriguer. His father had been on the side of Jan Zapolje, the national king of Hungary. His father had even given up Habsburg and Polish royal service in order to enter service of the Hungarian crown for this popular king. So what we're now seeing is how John Dee enters a very complex world of continental diplomacy, first on the side of Polish princes who would be king of Poland and against Habsburg. And in due course, of course, John Dee would go to Rudolf's Prague, consort and speak with the emperor at length, and in due course, pass on to perhaps the strongest and mightiest of noble families here in the Czech lands, Rosenberg. Willem of Rosenberg and his brother Peter Vok Rosenberg, who of course had vast estates in this part of South Bohemia. First of all, let me talk quickly about Prince Albert Waski, and secondly about Rudolf, and then about the Rosenberg family, because once I've done that, we get a picture of what John Dee is doing here on the continent and what significance it has for the Rosicrucians and their hopes of a new age in the 17th century. A new age that was very much at the forefront of the establishment. A new age that involved traffic and intercourse with kings, princes, and emperors. It was not just a matter of being amongst occultists in dark backroom basements and casting spells with Edward Kelly. They journeyed in September 1583 to the east. They set off by boat from Mortlake and passed, first of all, to the Dutch coast. The map of Europe was not unlike this then. The Kingdom of Poland, of which Aski had come to Oxford to meet Elizabeth, and fated in Oxford with plays and banquets in his honor. Philip Sidney brought Waski to Dee's house in Mortlake, and Waski, within a fortnight, was on first-name terms with Dee, staying at his house, enjoying his table, talking all night with him about what they might do if Dee ever cared to come to Poland. That was in June. In September, they're on the boat together. They're sailing out off the Queensborough Sands, and they've docked in Holland. The journey took them first along the coast of Holland, overland from Bremen to Hamburg, overland then to Lübeck, and then from Lübeck to Stralsund, into Stettin, and by February, they've reached via Poznan and Mieko. They've reached here in the middle of snowbound Polish winter over vast snowy wastes and icebound bridges where rivers swept away huge seven-arch bridges with ice blocks and floes. They came to the castle of Wask, the center of Prince Albert Wask's realms. Now this nobleman harbored thoughts of kingship. And again, we see Faustian compacts of a sort. Perhaps Waski was seeing Dee, not unlike Faust. A man who could help him gain the kingdom of Poland. Perhaps someone who else could look into this crystal and tell him what the angels thought. Not just about the secrets of the universe, but about the political future of Europe. Because prophecy, apocalyptic expectations were a very important part of 16th century Europe. Times were often bad. There was rampant inflation. The common people were very concerned. The kingdoms of Poland, the Emperor of Austria, in some respects, leadership, the elite seemed to have lost touch. There was a sense in which things were drifting. Rudolf had confined himself here in the Hradčín at Prague. He was not the first emperor to go to Prague. I mean, we must remember Prague is the center of Europe. It had been, in fact, the imperial residence under the Luxembourgs in the 15th century when Emperor Charles IV came to Prague to make it the imperial capital. We should also remember that, of course, at this time, Prague was the first university of the Germanic and Germanic-speaking world and the Holy Roman Empire. Founded in 1348, this is something like the 10th university to be founded in Europe after the universities of Oxford, Paris, and Florence, and Bologna, and then, of course, another further swathe in the Low Countries and the Romance countries. But Prague was the first university of the German-speaking countries and the first university of the Roman Empire. It was an imperial capital. And when we walk in the streets of Prague, if we've already been there or if we go on Monday, we must just imagine it as that sunlit Renaissance world, Renaissance divines walking in their robes down the cobbles and the plasters past the Renaissance palaces. We must also imagine Krakow like that. It's a sunlit world of Renaissance when people can actually imagine a universal world. Knowledge seems within people's grasp, some sort of universal religion. These are ideas that haunt the late 16th century. They haunt the intellectual leadership. But at the same time, there is an undertone of prophecy and apocalyptic, a concern with comets, a concern with signs in the heavens, a concern that the world may be coming to an end. That's the world of John Dee and Kelly. That's the world of their scrying. It's an extraordinary thing, but as one goes through these manuscripts, what one finds time and time again is that there are references to the end of the world. Apocalypse, destruction, rivers of blood, beasts, men, all mixed up in the rivers, dead, carcasses,
dying. It's a very dark literature. The date 1588 comes up time and time again. And the reason for that, it was based on various apocalyptic prophecies reaching back to this comet in 1532. This comet had been observed by Paracelsus in 1532 and also documented by other astronomers of the period. But what's very interesting about it is, of course, that it very much wove into the tapestry of prophecy accruing from Joachim of Fiore with his idea of the three ages, the age of the Father, the age of the Son, and the age of the Holy Ghost. And that tripartite division of the philosophy of history was something that occupied many Renaissance divines in their calculation of when the second coming might arrive. The thing about this comet, of course, is that it recalled the Star of Bethlehem. And the Star of Bethlehem may well have, in fact, been a comet. On the other hand, it may have been a conjunction of two planets at the time, and it's well known astronomical fact that around the time of Christ's birth, there was a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn that created this long-tailed astronomical phenomenon. But the point is, if comets came again, they could suggest the second coming. They could suggest the third age of the Holy Ghost. And that is what is constantly coming through this crystal. Whether it came through this crystal, I don't know. But it certainly came through the crystal in the British Museum. Those are very dark apocalyptic prophecies, and they're constantly mediated by those angels talking in strange languages like Enochian that go back to Pseudo-Dionysius, that goes back to angelical books of the super-celestial hierarchies. D, through his, if you like, Pseudo-Dionysian medium, Kelly, was reading about the end of the world. That is the reason for his urgency. That is the reason he's seeking out men of power. That is why he goes to Prince Albert Waski of Poland. That is why he goes to Emperor Rudolf, and ultimately to Wilhelm Rosenberg. The thing about this literature is that it is quite extraordinarily suffused with pious sentiment. Anyone who thinks that Dee is a magician simply has to go through this literature, as I have done recently, and see how he opens every conference with the angels, angels he could neither see nor hear, but relied on Kelly to communicate with in terms of everything he was doing. When he first met Rudolf, the emperor maintained a court here in Prague, up at the Hradčín and down in the center of Prague, that involved a great number of alchemists, physicians, court physicians. They were all around him. The extraordinary thing about Rudolf's court is that it really was some kind of alchemical scientific establishment. But that's not surprising if we recall the importance of Paracelsus on the continent from 1550 onwards. When Dee first met the emperor, this is what he said to him. And I think it's worth quoting in some detail, because after Dee had left Poland, left the castle of Wask, and moved on through Krakow, where he also did some more very interesting communications, he came to stay with Tadeusz Hayek, also a court physician to Rudolf, who maintained a very attractive house, a mansion near the Bethlehem Chapel in Old Prague. And we can still see that house where Dee lived, together with his family and that of Edward Kelly's, in the court physician's house near the Bethlehem Chapel. I like to think that the presence